Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books and Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More than you'll ever need to know about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with independent scholar Dr. Gitanjali Srikantan about a fascinating new 2020 Cambridge University press publication, Identifying and Regulating Religion in India. The subtitle of the book is Law, History, and the Place of Worship. Very apropos our podcast themes here. Gitanjali, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So maybe as you may have gathered, my job is to ask ridiculous, naive questions that perhaps might prompt some discussion and might think alongside a generalist listenership. But let me ask this question. What is the core problem or issue? What is the phenomenon or problem that the book seeks to address?
The main problem is that religion can't be defined in law, and Indian judiciary has spent a lot of time trying to figure this out. And this forms a huge problem because they have come up with something called the Essential Practices Test, which does not have a clear methodology. And overall, they come out with contradictory decisions regarding how they define religion. That's the core problem which I'm trying to investigate. And I investigated through the place of worship, because places of worship are being highly contested these days in India. And the question of religion and how one defines religion, religious freedom, it becomes most important.
This is a most fascinating line of inquiry. As anyone who's ever taken a religious studies class may be well aware, religion is an evasive category through the scholarly lens anyhow. And this is a problem. This is a problem for religious studies. This is a problem for various theorists. But when this problem intersects with legal codes and enforcement thereof upon people, this problem becomes less of a pedantic one and more of a very practical one with real life repercussions. Could you disentangle this a bit for us? Like, why is it so problematic to define religion in this context? And why is it so crucial for there to be a definition of religion?
Just to very briefly answer this question, it's a complex problem which has to be disentangled. One is that there is a colonial understanding of religion, and judges do not have any understanding of how religion is a self-referential entity. And very often they have a textual understanding of religion. They look for texts and they try to find them, and which they do not succeed in doing it. And they refer to other kinds of materials, such as a history or anecdotal evidence, in order to come out with an understanding of religion. So this is the main problem, because in many ways also they have to be theologians. They have to go into texts, into religious texts, and decide, and they do not have any kind of understanding of religion to be able to do that.
Could you give us an example of some of the sorts of decisions that are implicated in the idea of religion?
Well, there is one very important case called the Anand Marga case, which was a procession by certain people in the region of Bengal, where they used knives and certain other kinds of sharp implements, and the police said that this is harmful and we cannot allow you to take out such a procession based on your claim to religious freedom. So it went to a number of courts, and what the decision was that this is not a case of religious freedom, because there's no text by the Anand Marga founder. And because of this, they were denied the right to take out processions as an exercise in religious freedom. So eventually, there was a series of texts that were compiled. And when they went back to the courts again, the courts agreed that one could take out this procession because there was textual evidence. There was also another case regarding cow slaughter, where it was held that cow slaughter is not something that is mentioned in the Quran. The courts relied on textual evidence. They went into the Quran for this. And in the case of trying to determine whether a Muslim person can grow beards, they said many Muslim dignitaries can have beards, and thus the evidence is very anecdotal. There's no kind of consistent methodology.
Could you maybe flesh out why reliance on text or looking to textual evidence might be problematic in some situations?
The reliance on textual evidence is basically because we are following a conception from the Abrahamic religions. And we seem to look for texts because they contain the doctrines of religion. And it's the search for doctrines by courts which make the decision to decision making regarding religious freedom so difficult.
So now that we've set the scene, what does your book posit or argue? What is the central thrust of your book?
Well, what the book tries to do is look at how the category of religion has come into place and in law. So it traces an intellectual history of the category of religion in respect to the place of worship. And what I try to do is show how these categories have been formed, particularly Hindu law and Islamic law, and what are the key concepts, such as the secular concept of charity, the idea of God, authority, the public and the private, and how places of worship and how we think of places of worship as Hindu or Islamic are fashioned, and why do we actually even think of these places as places of worship?
So over the course of this argument, what sorts of data are you looking at?
Well, I look at court judgments and also material in archives, colonial histories in archives, such as legislative debates, the works of colonial administrators. And in looking at one particular key case, which is known as the Swaminarayan case, where the definition of Hinduism became very, very central, I looked at the original records at the Supreme Court and to see what evidence the Supreme Court used in order to make the decision.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about how the book is structured.
Well, what I do is begin by looking at the problem of religious freedom as such, and try to see why courts have such great difficulties. I define the nature of the problem, after which I look at how Hindu law, for instance, has been formed and how Islamic law has also been formed. What are the principles behind it and what are the legal histories behind it? And in looking at that, I move on to the place of worship and try to understand how the place of worship is structured. What are the kinds of concepts which go into it, such as the idea of charity and also the themes of God, authority, the juristic status of the idol, the question of dedication, And I finally show in the contemporary context that the definition of religion and law really has no meaning as such. It is impossible to define religion and law, as we can see in the Shastri Agna Purushtas case, where many of the litigants came out with all kinds of evidence, which the Supreme Court did not take into account. There's a mismatch between the evidence and the actual decision.
What might be the path forward then? What do we do with this problematic term of religion?
Well, what we can do is look, for instance, at how this framework is conceptually flawed and have a different kind of framework in order to understand the practices and traditions. For instance, having an all-encompassing definition of religion as being focused on text instead of practice, or not interrogating the practices themselves as representing individual religions, as individual traditions, is something that we can do. Just one second. Can you stop recording 1 minute? So the question is that one has to interrogate practices of a tradition and not merely try to encompass it into a larger religion with texts and the idea of a founder and the idea of doctrines itself.
You've touched on an idea a couple of times that I think we might want to unpack, the idea of the legal status of the murti.
Right, yeah.
Could you say a bit more about this? Why would that matter?
The legal status of the idol matters because the question is, how do we really define a place of worship? And what has happened over the 100 years of legal history is that the idol or image-based worship has started to assume a great deal of importance within British colonial history. They have kind of ignored a number of other practices. What I do, for instance, is that I look at how there's no place of worship in the 19th century, and places of worship were categorized by their function. There was no Hindu endowment and there was no Islamic endowment, but you had different categories like the Muzaffi Khana or the graveyard or the mosque or the dargah. And what happens in this intervening period is that a number of legal concepts come into being, such as juristic status, the idea of dedication, etc. Now, the notion or conception of the idol becomes very important because the British want to know what is God within Hinduism. And it's very central to defining Hinduism as a religion and as a Hindu place of worship. So that becomes very important for the British, and the result of which they give juristic status to the idol. There's an entire theological rationality behind it because they see the idol as representative of God, which is not how worshippers or Hindus, normal Hindus would see it. And they see the act of Hindus having darshan as worship. And the question of worship is also very different because worship in a Christian context means worshiping God, who's the creator of the universe. The idol cannot be the creator of the universe. So the idol is very central to their own conception of Hinduism. And they need a custodian to act for it, which is why they see the idol as having this property, but not being able to act, but having a custodian or a shabayat or a dharmakarta, multiple authorities who act for it and manage the property.
Fascinating. I'm going to ask you a question that I normally ask at the outset, but I thought it important to set the stage first. How did you become interested in this? What prompted you to pursue this path of research?
Well, when I was working in a human rights NGO many years ago, I was involved in giving advice on a litigation in relation to a space called the Baba Budangiri Dargah. And this was a place of worship frequented by both Hindus and Muslims. And in the 70s, became the target of a takeover by the Waqf board, who claimed that this is a Muslim endowment and we want to take it over. However, the Hindu devotees objected and said, no, we worship at this particular space, and it's not correct that it be declared a Muslim place of worship. So what happened is that a court said that this place of worship is not Hindu or Muslim. It's beyond that, and the Hindu devotees had a right to worship at that place. So later on in the 80s, Hindu right-wing groups tried to take over this place, saying it's a Hindu place of worship and that there's no saint there, but instead this is the seat of a deity called Dattatreya. And therefore Hindus should be allowed to worship there and Vedic pujas should be performed over there. So this litigation, incidentally, is still going on, and have been many kinds of developments, including a particular time in the year where the Hindu right groups, Hindu right wing groups, are allowed into this particular dargah, and they have Vedic pujas. And there's a continuous kind of attempt to convert this particular shrine. So the question that was very central to this litigation is, what is really religion? And what is really religious freedom? So do these Hindu groups have the right to perform these Vedic pujas? And how do we understand these practices at the dargah, which has some Hindu religious objects and also the grave of a Muslim saint? How do we actually understand this? And how can we understand the exercise of religious freedom in this regard, because it does not fall under a normative conception of worship in an Islamic context?
What sorts of readers might most benefit from this book, whether subfields, specialists, generalists? You know, who would get the most out of this book?
Anybody who's really interested in questions of how we look at places of worship today, and the kinds of developments that are happening, where there are so many attempts to change places of worship. It's all over the newspapers right now with the Gyan Bapi Mosque, and as well as the mosque in Madura. So people who are interested in this kind of topic would benefit from reading my book to understand these litigations better, and how various kinds of litigants come forward and make claims. So this would benefit them, because I analyze the main legal concepts behind these kinds of claims. Lawyers would also benefit in understanding the origins of how religious law has been formed in India, the origins of Hindu and Islamic law in a modern context, as well as students of law who are studying modern Hindu family law and modern Islamic family law in their classrooms.
Is this work that you plan on continuing? Is this this research, is it something you'd like to continue?
Well, I don't actually plan to continue this research as such, but perhaps try to apply it more in the context of current developments as such. Since this topic is really controversial, I don't really work on it much more, but I'm interested in seeing how this is applied to current developments. And I believe that my work is a useful guide to many controversies around places of worship today.
If you could offer a bit of conjecture, how might this research potentially be applied?
Well, there are many ways in which you can apply this this research in the context of understanding the motivations of parties that come forward, and what are the openings within the law which allow them to come forward. For instance, the entire way in which the debates on places of worship unfold, or the kinds of claims that are made, there is this conceptualization that a Hindu place of worship is a public place of worship, and any Hindu can come forward and make this claim. So many parties, Hindu right-wing parties, any ordinary individual who considers himself Hindu can come forward. So what my book does, it shows that this was not always there. And when religious endowments were debated in legislative assemblies, people raised concerns about the fact that this definition of Hindu was problematic, that anybody could come forward and say that they could worship in a temple. And some, in fact, there is a comment that somebody from Peshawar can come and make a claim in the Malabar. So, and anybody who's just dissatisfied with the affairs of the temple can raise a certain claim on the affairs of the temple, the fact that it's not managed, or the fact that he or she did not have the right to worship in a particular manner. So I think the nominative category of the public to make a claim that they are Hindu, and the fact that image-based worship or the idol was so central to British conceptions of a Hindu place of worship is something that's been inherited, which is what many of these Hindu right-wing parties follow. They claim that there is a Hindu religious object and therefore they have the right to worship. So these two categories of the public and the idea of the idol and its importance in the last 100 years, which has come about through judicial discourse, is very relevant in understanding developments today.
Is there anything else about the book that you'd like to touch on before we close for today?
I think we've covered a lot, so I don't think I have much to say. And I hope that people can read this book to reflect more on current questions today, and also reflect on the manner and the way in which we understand places of worship, and also be more critical of the legal concepts that we are using in relation to places of worship. There is a trend today in trying to understand litigation on places of worship through these legal concepts, and saying that this particular litigation has not been carried out properly because courts have given out these decisions which are based on an inadequate understanding of the law. But what I argue is that the legal framework is flawed, and it's important to think of a new legal framework in the context of places of worship.
Fascinating. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
For those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Gitanjali Srikantan on her brand new Cambridge University Press publication, Identifying and Regulating Religion in India. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, and keep contemplating the interplay between religion and law. Take care.